thanks for coming back. This is a panel that is on parent-focused interventions. And while the presentations are listed in the program in alphabetical order of the last name of the presenter, we're actually going to do it in the order of age of focus of the investigators. So this was actually Eric's idea. This is to promote a little bit of cognitive flexibility, so stick with us. We're going to start with Betty Voor. Betty is a professor of pediatrics at the Albert Medical School of Brown University and the director of the neonatal follow-up clinic at Women and Infants Hospital. And she's going to talk today about a need for language intervention in NICU preterm infants. Betty.
Thank you so much. And I think I'm going to stand. I'm used to standing while speaking. First of all, I'd like to thank the Lena Foundation and Judy and her family for inviting me to participate. And it's such a pleasure to be here with all of you, everyone invested in the same improved outcomes for every single child in the United States. It's interesting how I became interested in Lena. I've been very interested in language development for many years, first for children with hearing loss, and Rhode Island was the first state to have universal newborn hearing screening. But it happened at a meeting of individuals and researchers involved with hearing loss in Breckenridge that the Lena Foundation had a representative there talking about this brand new device for measuring the language environment, and only weighed 2 ounces. And my other area of interest was preemies in the intensive care unit. And I thought, wow, this is exciting. Could this possibly work? Because everyone had said preemies don't vocalize. They start to cry, they have this weak cry, and then the language develops in the months after they reach their due date and after they go home. So that's how it all started. And I'm going to go a little bit first into brain development, because our preemies are in the neonatal intensive care unit during the second and third trimester, when ordinarily they would be in the protected environment of the uterus. And this is an incredible time of brain development. We've heard a lot today about plasticity, but there's a lot going on there between 10 and 40 weeks. Neurons are multiplying, maturing, there's migration of pathways, and lots of exciting things happening. So here, this line is 25 weeks, and you may know now that we have babies surviving at 22, 23, 24, 25 weeks. Survival has changed dramatically over the past 30 years. And these babies may spend 4, 5, 6 months in an intensive care unit before going home with their families. So during this time, there's a 4-fold increase in cortical gray matter. There's dramatic increases in white matter.
What is really critical during this time period is really the sensory environment and the experience that these infants have in the neonatal intensive care unit. So this is one of the first studies done by Terry Inder, who's now at Harvard. On the x-axis, you see the gestational age, and in the shaded bar on the right-hand side of your screen is what the cortical deep matter gray matter volume is for full-term infants at term age. Then as we go all the way down on the left to 23, 24 weeks gestation, that is their brain volume when they reach term age. So they start out leaving the intensive care unit at a distinct disadvantage. Well, in terms of size anyway, but how much does brain size matter? Look around the room. There's a lot of variation here in the room. So we've been following a cohort for 16 years between Yale Main Medical Center and Women and Infants, and this is at 8 years of age. On the x-axis, you have full-scale IQ. On the right axis, you have the right mid-temporal volume. And we see there's a direct correlation there. So this persists. And so the size of the brain impacts as late as 8 years. And we did MRIs at 12 years and 16 years. It persists. And we do know that preemie infants as a whole have language delays. And this is meta-analysis and showing forest plots for simple language skills and on the top, and more complex language skills on the bottom. And essentially, all of the studies show delays of preterm infants when you have a comparison group of full-term infants. But then we want to know, can any of them really catch up? And we have followed some long-term, and they're very successful professionals now. Well, on the left, you can see the dark line going up compares infants without any evidence of any brain injury at the time of discharge. So they had no bleeds, no cystic PBL. So they make good progress as a whole and do quite well between 3 and 12 years of age. The ones who have significant brain injury are improving also, but at a much lower rate. But on the right is, again, is really important. It's level of education. So the moms in the dark line on the top with college education, their children have the most progress in their Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test scores. Those with high school education have a slower trajectory, and those with less than a high school education have the least. When we did multivariate analysis, just focus on the three issues on the bottom, the demographics of the family. So for maternal years of education, each additional year, you can add 2 points to the IQ over time. A single family household lowers it by 5.9 points. Minority status lowered it by 8 points. So something's going on here. Even though we're seeing recovery, there are these social factors. We, of course, see severe brain injury up there. So we then look at it separating that out. So here we see patterns of receptive language development between 8 and 16 years of age. And we did hierarchical cluster analysis. So we identified clusters of infants with similar characteristics. And what differentiated them was that the clusters in A had the mothers with the highest education, B somewhat lower education, C somewhat lower. And in the D group, it was the children with sensory neural impairment, cerebral palsy, blindness, deafness. So you see the three other groups catch up. But those in A and B are actually very similar clusters to full-term children. So some of the children, the subgroups in different environments, which is potentially more enriched, do have that potential to catch up, and it decreases with the environmental changes. So let's think about why they're particularly vulnerable at birth. The language environment of a term pregnancy, it's a warm, comfortable little place to stay. You hear your mother's voice whenever she speaks throughout the entire pregnancy. Comes through as sort of a low-frequency sound production because it's going through the liquid of the amniotic fluid. However, we do know that full-term babies prefer their mother's voices to any other acoustical stimulus at the time of birth, and in fact, by some studies now between 1 and 3 days of age, they prefer their mother's voice to any other woman's voice. So why is the sensory environment of the isolette, which is really the uterus and the NICU, so different? And why might there be a problem with sensory input? Well, suddenly they're in this room where there's very high, steady levels of noise. There's increased ambient light often for 24 hours a day. There's lots of stressful manipulation with being intubated, having bloods drawn. There's decreased soothing stimulation. There's decreased developmentally appropriate stimulation in multiple caregivers. And for many years, mothers were really restricted in the amounts of times they could actually visit in the intensive care unit. So this is all going on, but people would look at these babies with eyes still fused, they can't suck, they can't breathe on their own, they're on a ventilator. What are they really perceiving? Hugo Lagercrantz at the Karolinska has done studies showing that consciousness actually emerges with the establishment of the corticothalamic connections at about 24 to 32 weeks. So infants start perceiving sensations and motor signals. They respond by 24 weeks to auditory stimuli. Think of this, 16 weeks before their due date, and we do know there are certain studies that our obstetric friends do now to look at infant responses to sound. And by 28 weeks, they have very consistent responses to both auditory and visual stimuli. So we can tell, with those of us who work in a NICU, that there are problems. Can this language environment be changed, and how can we incorporate the importance of parent talk? This is our first study that was done with Melinda Caskey, who was a fellow with me. And it was a prospective study of very small infants under 2 pounds, 8 ounces, with recordings at 32 and 36 weeks. Here we see a baby in the little Lena vest. She still has nasal CPAP on. But once they were extubated, majority of them by about 32 weeks, so we could hear potential vocalizations, was when we did the assessment. So the objective was to measure the adult word counts, the vocalizations, and the conversational turns, and to test the association of the maternal counts with the infant responses. We then followed the children for 18 months and wanted to know, would the turns, conversational turns, and the adult word count predict what's happening once they leave the NICU? 16-hour recordings, standardly. So this is it. The average gestational age was 27 weeks. So these were really small babies. Birth weight, just around 2 pounds. Maternal age, 30. So this is the language environment. I'd like you to focus on the two areas that are yellow. That's the language environment, total language environment. It was only 2.1% of the time at 32 weeks. And it increased to about 5.3% of the time at 36 weeks. The black, I put silence as black because, it's really sensory deprivation. The white is lots of noise. The green is all sorts of electronic noise, ventilators, alarms. We also have freezers in the room for breast milk. There's all kinds of the computers, mechanical noise. So we did find, however, I should say it was so exciting when the Lena Foundation sent me the first processor and I plugged it in and recorded for like 5 hours, brought it back to my computer, they linked into my computer, did the analysis and said, yes, there are vocalizations. So we knew we could move ahead with this. And we knew it was a real challenge for mothers to come in, many of them. There's so many barriers for some of the moms. So at 32 weeks, this is total adult word count, was a mean of 3,306, went up to over 8,000, so it was 160% increase. So we saw that it increased with time, and it was the same thing for vocalizations, dramatic increase, but 8 weeks before the due date, they had them, and 4 weeks before their due date. Conversational turns went from 25 to 48, 95% increase. Now look at this carefully for those of you who use Lena. What is wrong with this picture? This is a 29-week baby, now at 32 weeks, in a giraffe bed. Continuous feeds, room air, no visiting. And what we learned was not only if the mom doesn't visit is no one speaking, the nurses don't seem to be talking to these tiny babies, the doctors aren't talking to these babies, the person coming in to draw the blood doesn't say, as they might with a 7 to 12 month old, it's going to hurt a little bit, but I'm going to draw your blood now. So it's really a sensory-deprived environment, almost like a child who's deaf, hard of hearing in the first months of life. So maybe that has an impact on brain development. In contrast, we do have mothers who we call the talkers. They come in. This is a 25-week gestation infant at 36 weeks in room air, getting PO foods. And this mom comes in, you can see, at noon, 4 p.m., 8 p.m., and 12 a.m. Now, that is a dedicated mom. She's coming in for all of the feeds, but look at the responses. You see the reflection and the infant vocalizations and the turn counts. Now, fortunately, this baby had a nurse who did a little bit of talking in the room, too. But we found there was a tremendous amount of variability. So what we found was that the hourly adult word counts during a parent visit are compared here was staff present in blue and parent present in white. And look at those differences. And that's why in our new single room nursery, this was all done in an open bay. Our hope is that parents can come, some of them, and just stay 24/7 or stay for 6 to 8 hours a day, because this is quite a difference. So I have the ranges at 32 weeks for moms, though. And you can see one mom, her hourly word count was 6 words. And another one, it was up to 3,742. Same thing we see at 36 weeks, again in the red. There's some parents who speak very little, 14 words up to 7,000. So we see differential exposure to auditory sensory input. Here we see changes again in vocalizations and conversational turns. And again here, this is just the mean adult word count for parent visiting, 1,427 versus 415. So dramatic differences in variability. When we did correlations to look at the relationship between adult word count and child vocalizations, on the top panel, look at the x-axis. It goes all the way over to 3,000 and 5,000 at 36 weeks. But then on the bottom is when only nurses are present. So indeed, some of the nurses and physicians going into the room are speaking, but very, very little. And they're in there for care, feeding, etc. So we have a ways to go there. Their 7 and 18-month scores, we see, again, the greatest impact on language, 78 and 85, whereas the cognitive scores were somewhat better. And then we looked at the correlations between the conversational turns on the top at 7 and 18 months, at 32 weeks with Bailey scores at 7 and 18 months, they're all significant. And so we saw these relationships, and we ran a regression analysis here. So sometimes all of these numbers are a little bit difficult to understand, but I'll talk to you about it. So the adult word count that the mother gave at 32 weeks accounted for about 12% of the language composite score variance and 20% of the expressive communication. So sometimes it's difficult to understand variance. If everything was accounted for, it would be 100%. But what did it really mean? For every additional 100 words that the mother spoke at 32 weeks, it was associated with a 2-point increase in the language composite score. And remember, some of those differences were between 10 words and thousands of words, so the spectrum of difference there is pretty dramatic. And at 36 weeks, adult word count, again, was associated with a 1.2-point increase in the cognitive composite and a third of a point in expressive communication. We also did regressions looking at conversational turns, and I'm a real believer it's the conversational turns are more important, because we found occasionally you have parents, you think your word count's high, but they're actually on their cell phone holding the baby. They're not really communicating directly with their baby. So the communicative composite score increased an average of 1.7 months at 7 months. And for conversational turns, the language composite score increased by 5.3 points. So again, the conversational turns are so important.
Our summary adult word counts among infants in the NICU are so variable. And we do know now that preterm infants begin to make these vocalizations at least 8 weeks before their due date, and we want to look now even lower than that. And we know that in many NICUs now, the percent of sounds that are language that an infant is exposed to is very limited and is totally dependent on parent visiting. We have to do a lot of education, not only with parents, but with nurses, and that it has strong predictive effects. It impacts on their language. And I think parents really have to be made aware of the powerful impact of language exposure in the NICU. And we actually have several randomized control trials going on right now with an intervention, so that we hope that we can share this with our other friends in neonatology. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Betty. What I'm going to suggest is that you hold questions for individual presenters, and we'll do that at the end. I'm hoping that somebody will talk about the effects of tutus on language development as well. Next, at the far end of my left is Anne Fernald. Anne is the Josephine Knotts Knowles Professor in Human Biology at Stanford, where she directs the Language Learning Lab in the Department of Psychology. And today she's going to talk about how cultural differences in parenting beliefs and practices inform intervention strategies. Anne.
Thank you. And can you hear me? No. Okay. Well, how about that? That's something it needs to be boosted. I would like to thank Lena and all the wonderful energy and creativity and commitment and passion in this room is just exciting to be part of. I was at one of the earlier Lena meetings, which was also wonderful, but that was back in the day when people were figuring out how to use this incredible new resource. And here there's a shared sense of mission and goal and openness to new ideas that we are celebrating together, thanks in part to Lena. My own work in speech to children goes back a long way. I became a mother in Germany, which is a different culture, not as different as some of the ones I'm going to talk to you about compared to the US, but where I could hear myself with my little newborn neighbor saying, "Bist du doch süß?" and thinking, whoa, what was that? Right, a two-octave swoop to a total stranger who doesn't know English or German, and what am I doing? Is this performance art for the mother? What is it? My husband was working at that time with Konrad Lorenz at the Max Planck Institute, where they were studying animal communication. This seemed to be much more like animal communication, where the child was listening to the melodies and the rhythms of the speech and connecting through emotion rather than through the symbolic code that rides along on those intonation contours. So that's where my work began, was squeezing the music out of speech. And I got very interested in cross-cultural similarities as well as differences, and went to Japan and Germany and France and Italy and made recordings, finding similar patterns. When you praise a child, you do something like, "Ja, gut," or "Bravissima." You don't say, "Good." I mean, it's just not culturally negotiable, that particular message, right? My life then took other turns, and I started asking about how children understand speech, developed some methods for reading babies' minds very, very young, and got into then the question of differences among mothers, because I had been working in child-centered cultures with mothers all of whom were wealthy and educated, and came to the point where I wanted to translate our research into action, and that's what I want to share with you today. I'm going to be telling you about two intervention studies designed to increase parent engagement with infants. I'll be sharing with you some positive findings and a lot of insights about lessons learned. I changed this presentation all around after reading a paper that I want to tell you about, because I thought that this would be an occasion to talk about how hard it is and how much better a job we could do if we understood some of these complex issues more in a more nuanced and deep way. So let me introduce you to this article here, Radical Insights from Neonatology. Most of the authors are from the Uttar Pradesh area of India, where they've been working, and Gary Darmstadt is a new colleague in pediatrics at Stanford. This group in 2005 published a paper in The Lancet in which they said, hey, there's good news. There are seven practices that if people would adopt these practices in the birth process. These folks are very interested in reducing infant mortality at birth. So you adopt these seven practices, and we could reduce those unnecessary deaths 3 million a year by more than 70%. And guess what? They're natural feeling, right? They're free. They have a demonstrated high success rate. So the practices they mentioned were wash your hands before helping to deliver a baby. Another one was use skin-to-skin contact. You don't have, maybe especially for premature babies, you don't have incubators in these towns. So skin-to-skin contact to avoid death by hypothermia, which is very, very common.
And breastfeeding, including drinking the colostrum, which is so good for immune function. Well, 10 years later, they had another depressing article. I mean, this was an optimistic one, saying we've made so little progress. 3 million babies a year have died because, who would have been otherwise saved if we had been able to change parents and communities' behavior in this way? Why is it so hard? So this wonderful article is all about that, and it's in, you can barely read it, Seminars in Perinatology. I will send anyone the actual reference later on, but it's quite incredible, and here's a quote from it. There we go. One of the key reasons for the failure of interactions to translate into behavior change is our failure to recognize that the content, the context, and the process of interactions need to be designed keeping in mind an organized community system and a very different worldview and belief system. These worldviews are not mysterious black boxes, these cultural differences, but in fact they reflect a thoughtfully designed community system that has evolved over many years, guided by a certain worldview and by common social purpose. So looked at that way, the example they start with is hand washing interventions fail and fail and fail. Water is a precious resource, but nevertheless, making it more accessible, it just doesn't work. And then you talk with the mothers in this area of India, and you find out that there is a theory of ritual pollution, especially related to bodily fluids, where you want to clean yourself after you have become polluted. And you certainly don't waste time cleaning hands that are already clean. So absent a germ theory, you are not going to waste that precious water on washing your hands. You're going to wait till you've got something to wash off of your hands. And that is a practice that is deeply entrenched and very, very hard to budge. So Kumar and Darmstadt make this point. Intervention interactions occur between two different socio-cognitive systems, not just between individuals. So we tend to think that here we are as the facilitator or the designer of the program, and our goal is to connect with this mother in a way that will change her behavior, right? Like, this is the dyad we are focused on, and we're successful by evaluating things at this level. Actually, it's the child we want to reach. But more to the point, there are layers and layers and layers of other people who are stakeholders in the mother's behavior. Now, in something like the Indian beliefs around childbearing, they started by identifying root beliefs related to newborn care and found out that the ritual pollution I've already mentioned, the evil eye and the evil spirit, you want to keep the mother locked away from other people because she is polluted, because she's covered with bodily fluids. So she's lying in a dark room protected from the evil eye. The mother herself is not empowered to make any decisions. The baby is delivered on the floor. Cows being ritual animals in sacred animals in that culture, the umbilical stump is often rubbed with cow dung. The umbilical cord may not be cut for hours afterward because they have to bring an untouchable in to do that. She's the only one that can do that. The baby, meanwhile, may die of hypothermia. Why doesn't the mother put it on her breast? Because that would be polluting. And we're not just talking about getting dirty. We're talking about fundamental spiritual pollution that has long-term consequences. So if you don't understand that system, and think, just why aren't people rational about washing their hands? It's just their emphasis is on, look, 90% of our kids survive, 10% don't. We can live with that. But I'm not gonna talk anymore about that. I want you to look at that article if you're at all interested in this, because it really, really spells it out very beautifully. So how do you manage behavior change then? Well, they focus on not just communicating knowledge, actually building skills in different ways. This may take well more than 8 weeks. It may take personal coaching as well as group events. This has been brought up before by several of the speakers, ensuring that the family is motivated, that they desire to do this, and how do you build self-esteem that then builds motivation to be part of success, like Ralph Smith was talking about. So the point that he's making is that we have to constantly negotiate an enabling environment that includes the mother-in-law, who is very entrenched in these beliefs, that includes the father, who's the son of the mother-in-law, who can influence the wife, but in a limited way. It includes the religious leaders. It includes other people in the neighborhood. Because you don't change tradition capriciously. You do it at great risk if these social norms have stigmas associated with violation. All right, so what does this have to do with talking to children? Well, talking to children is something else that is free, in principle, easy to do. Why is it so hard to get people to do more of this? Well, as I said, I began my career looking at this, and by the way, these are the behaviors that dominate research on early social development in every lab in the country. We take them for granted, our Western model. And we ask, why is this a good thing? Well, it's a good thing because it children's vocabulary increases, and with that, their intelligence gets richer. And with that, they develop conceptually. They aren't just learning individual words. They're making connections between words. And they're also learning to ask questions and to be inquisitive and to challenge beliefs. These are adaptive in a culture where, for your adult success, you need to be able to ask questions, solve problems, challenge others. This is not the case in more traditional societies where you do not want a child who does those things, and as Kumar would argue, for very good reason. These are skills that are going to be very, very useful in school. And middle-class parents have that long-term view. Parents who come here from other cultures very likely do not see the utility in that and interpret it in an entirely different framework. So actually, many infants in the world grow up in very different circumstances. If the mother on the left there all day long is working with her baby on her back, not a lot of face-to-face contact is going to happen. She is, by the way, extremely attentive to every move that baby makes. If the child is hungry or upset, she will comfort the child and feed the child. But talk does not happen very much. Now let's look at the dyad on the right, which is from the Yucatan. There's a little child who will sit passively there. He's maybe 2.5. For several hours watching mothers weave. Well, that's a good thing in that culture. If you are going to grow up to be your mother or your father, and your mother and your father know everything you need to know, then paying attention to those adults is paramount. If you're going to inherit those cows that have been the family's wealth for generations, you better learn how to handle those cows. But what families in traditional cultures these days face is a very different future, where their children have to go to school and have to learn skills that the parents can't even begin to imagine. I mean, we can't imagine what our children are going to be up again in 20 years. These families in Senegal that we're working with have absolutely no way to envision that. Moreover, these children are often cared for by other children. And why is that? Because the mother, by 20 months, right, the toddler is mobile, moving around, and agile, and can obey by 20 months, and so he's outsourced to the peer group, and other siblings take care of the child. So the question is, do we have any business asking parents to change such cultural beliefs and traditional practices? And what there's obviously a lot of debate about this. I get a lot of pushback about, well, you're arguing from a deficit point of view. Who are you to push the hegemony of middle class practices onto people who've happily existed for 1,000 years, learning by observation and not asking questions because it was adaptive in that context. So then we have to face that conflict and help parents understand that their children are moving into a cultural context that they don't have experience in, and to learn new skills as well as cherishing their old ones. Okay, so let's back to the U.S. In the United States, what we call the achievement gap is a fact about children at age 5 years. But it doesn't start, and Ralph was making this point, it's not about the kids. it doesn't, by 5 years, it's about, you know, how do they perform on standardized tests. But early on, it starts as a gap in learning opportunities. And you see here the Ramey and Ramey plot showing how those kids diverge, and by the age of five, they are already, there's a 2-year gap. And we're going to look very, very early and see how early that begins. Eric reviewed some of this research this is a measure of processing efficiency here, trust me on that one. We've got low SES children at 18 and 14 months, high SES children at 18 and 14 months on this processing measure, which, by the way, is correlated with more sophisticated language skills. It's correlated with vocabulary growth. That's why it's of interest to us. And what you see is that it's not until 24 months that the low SES children reach the level of processing efficiency that the 18-month-olds started with 6 months earlier than that. These gaps tend not to close. The best that happens in school is that they stay level. This is a graph based on Lena here. We have 43 families over a 10-hour day. The families, the orange bars, are from lower SES Latino families in California. The green bars are the higher SES Latino families in Mexico City. We went to Mexico City because we wanted the mothers to be monolingual, just like the Palo Alto moms in our English samples were monolingual. You see huge variability in the amount of talk these kids hear. Here's one child at this end who hears 100 words in 5 minutes. And these words are not just the same word repeated over and over again. It's not rabbit, 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 bear, 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 right? It really isn't. It's about rabbits and bears are animals, and one has short ears and one has long ears. That's what all those little multicolored connections are. You're building up concepts of animals and other things. This little child at the other end of the distribution, these are both low SES kids. Hear 5 words in the same period. Sit down, long silence, hear some toys. Doesn't learn anything about bears or animals or little ears being like your ears. This is work done with Adriana Weisslader, and what she showed in her beautiful study and ongoing work is that these differences predict. You know, this is following up on Hart and Risley and giving a little more precision to that prediction. These differences predict later language outcomes. Okay. And what's impressive here is the huge variability. Look at the overlap between the orange and the green there. And the orange at the top there, we have a dad who's a low SES father who's very engaged with his child, and then lower down we call him a Google dad because he's Googling all the time. But many of our high SES families are way down there at the bottom. This is not about social class. These are messages for all children. Okay, so that led us to want to test a causal hypothesis. If we can say that these differences are linked meaningfully to processing efficiency, which is linked meaningfully to vocabulary, then we can we cause that by helping parents to engage more efficiently. And back to the interventions here, and this is going to have to be very quick. So we're going to start with Tostan, which is in Senegal here, and in the westernmost part of Africa, where we were working with a nonprofit called Tostan, that runs a community empowerment program focused on human rights. They are well known for success in changing deeply entrenched dark knowledge, they call this, which has to do with genital cutting and child marriage. They've been successful there in getting people together and deciding to renounce this practice. The reason they contacted us is that they were doing participatory research and discovered that many mothers reported that making eye contact with or talking to an infant attracted spirits who would replace them, possess them with a jinn or a goblin that made them a goblin infant, and one who was very, very dangerous for the family and often was put out to die. They were often abandoned. Many times they were suffering from marasmus, or they had birth problems of other sorts, or just needed oral rehydration. How has this worldview been adaptive over time, and why has this persisted for so long? Well, if infant mortality is high and you are going to lose an infant very likely, then as Nancy Shepherd Hughes argues so beautifully in Death Without Weeping, maybe you don't get too attached. Maybe that's a way to survive what you know is inevitable loss. Okay, so their program then was to try to address The RPP is the Renforcement des Pratiques Parentales, to try to address these beliefs using fancy scientific slides there on you can see in the middle, pretty high tech, doing home visits, group meetings in 200 rural villages. Our charge was to help them assess, we had nothing to do with designing the intervention, our charge was to help them assess whether they were successful in changing parents' behavior, and if so, whether change in parents' behavior was associated with change in kids' behavior as well. I wanted you to look down in the right-hand corner there with a red and white dress only. That's an example of role play where one woman is sitting there talking to a baby who's maybe a doll, and the woman in white comes out and says, "Why are you doing that? That's stupid. People will call you crazy. They'll say nobody's there. You're talking to nothing." And then she gets defensive, and the girl in red comes out and says, "Well, you know, I just learned that this you're actually helping brain development." So they participate in these conversations. They, through role play, actually engage in the kind of cultural pushback that they're very likely to be encountering. So it's a multimodal program that runs over 3 months that we have much to learn from. We do video observations of the caregiver and the child. We also do Lena. So we have Lena on 12 hours a day of 100 kids living in subsistence level villages without roads, without electricity, without water, and who are represented nowhere in our literature. We do deep dives, translating these the first 10 minutes of every second hour into Wolof and then into English or French in order to be able to do a closer read on the quality of speech. Here is the change in amount. I'm just going to show you one finding. The change in amount of mothers' and children's speech during a play session here. Okay, can you even see those little bars there? These are, I could show it to you as bar graphs, but this is so stunning. It's the frequency of dyads, over 500. This is a whole sample here. On the x-axis are number of words to the child in a 5-minute observation. The control, the RPP group or treatment group is blue. The control group is red. This is at baseline, before this program had happened. They're right smack on top of each other, pretty low. Here, 1 year later, no change in the amount of child-directed speech to the control group at follow-up. And here is the treatment group. A beautiful shift of the whole distribution over there, showing that speech almost doubled in that group. So that's the good news, right? That's the good news. You did change. They managed to change the behavior of mothers who are spending less and less time with their children at that point because the next baby has been born. So the bad news is that in the overall Lena recordings, we found no differences because it was picking up all 40 people who were interacting with the child in a small African village. The courtyard always has 10 of them in there. So if the village is raising the child, that increment of change in the mother's behavior may or may not be enough to drive the kind of change that Tostan is hoping for, but it's a very positive first step. Okay, almost done here. The second intervention is the Habla Conmigo intervention. I don't have time to tell you that, but I want to stress what Darmstadt and Kumar stressed, which is our goal is to build knowledge, to build skills, to build motivation, and to build an enabling environment with Latino families who are speaking only Spanish at home from very poor families in the in the Bay Area. These are the results from our first efficacy study. The amount of child-directed talk increased twice as much for the Habla Conmigo mothers as for controls. Habla Conmigo is in red. And then this was what was so surprising to us. Children vocabulary scores, actually the percentile scores increased by 9 points in the group that were in the Habla Conmigo, not at all in the control group. So pushing the dial just a little bit. But I want to stress that we're facing many of the same cultural issues there in the Latino families who come from often agrarian villages in Mexico with very, very different beliefs. We have to go much beyond just delivering intervention and modeling things. So let me end here with this metaphor from tennis. I love the Harvard site. And all that they have. Oops, are you fading me out? That's a good message. I love the Harvard site about serve and return. I question the use of a metaphor like this, a tennis metaphor, with families who probably have very little access to tennis and the rules of tennis. But the point is that tennis is a skill that requires lots and lots of practice and coaching. It's not enough to just give information. So we have to include all of these building blocks, knowledge, skills, motivation, and focusing on the enabling environment, starting with questioning of the cultural beliefs that hold the barriers in place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne. So I'm going to quickly point out that Serena Williams was wearing a tennis dress that actually looks a little bit like a tutu. Sitting immediately to my left is Susan Landry. Susan is the director of the Children's Learning Institute and the Albert and Margaret Elect Chair in Early Childhood, and she's busy, Michael Matthew Knight Professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. And today she is going to talk about key ingredients of interventions. What's right there? Targeting caregivers' language support for young children. Susan.
Well, I am also very delighted to be here today. I want to thank the LENA Foundation for inviting me. This is my first LENA conference, and it's truly an amazing conference. I'm thrilled to be here. So I will be talking about key ingredients of a intervention that we developed called Play and Learning Strategies, which is in a large number of states and communities across the United States, and is getting some traction with some different approaches that I'm going to emphasize today, different models. But this came out of a longitudinal study, 14 years of following and observing in their homes families with very low birth weight preemies, half of the sample, and half full-term healthy babies, but all from low-income backgrounds. And in being in these homes every year and sometimes multiple times a year across those 13 years of the children's lives, we were able to document that families, particularly in the very young years, first 3 years of life, were not aware that it was important to have mutual engagement, interactions, conversations with their children. Language was not directed to their infants and toddlers. The words that were said were very empty, like Anne has mentioned, get it, put it over there. Words that did not carry meaning, gestures, minimal in the infancy period. And there was very limited attention to what the child was interested in and building on those interests with rich intonation patterns that captured the child's attention and allowed them to learn from the language their caregivers were providing in their environment. So we mostly documented language like this first example. Put that away. Get it. Do you want that one? And so these children weren't hearing language like middle class children from families that know it's important to talk to your child with sentences like, oh, your ball, it rolled under the table, it's behind the chair leg. Why is your doll wearing that pretty dress today? That would elicit conversations and help children problem solve and think. And so from this study, and along with some wonderful research that I'm not going to repeat, Anne's research has been phenomenally important to let us know this starts very, very early, and it has a cascading effect. And we know from this very famous graph how this gap just keeps increasing and increasing. And what's striking to me is that at the end of this graph, 48 months, that's when kids are finally getting into preschool. That's where our attention is in the nation, to have children get this early childhood experience that's quality. But look what's happening at that time point. In our interventions with preschool classrooms, it's almost impossible to expect teachers to close this big gap by the time these children go into kindergarten. So it has to happen earlier. One thing we know is that these children are from poverty, and 41% of the children living in poverty hear a language other than English spoken in their homes. And they're often entering pre-K and formal schooling without English skills. And we know they should be developing their home language, but also the language they're expected to learn to read in. And so this makes it a more challenging situation. So we developed play and learning strategies out of the data from this longitudinal study where we found that the early input across the first 4 years of life was highly predictive of how children did in school, academically, socially, self-regulation, and consistency across infancy into pre-K was one of the most important factors, that it be highly responsive and stimulating. And so the concepts, identifying signals, which many parents don't realize are important. We often hear, gosh, I didn't know I should be watching, that my baby was really communicating before they knew how to talk. I thought I waited until they could carry on a conversation with me. So we're helping parents watch their babies and toddlers respond promptly, sensitively, contingently to what the child signals they need or are interested in, building on their interests, their attentional focus, and providing a lot of information through demonstrations, verbal input, gestures. And one thing we found in these homes in the longitudinal study was the devastating effect of highly restrictive behavior, a lot of don't, stop. In about half of our sample, 60% of the interactions between parents and their young children were of that nature. So this is sort of the format, the way PALS works. And the key ingredients are in this slide. We made, in Spanish and in English, we have PALS 1, which is the whole infancy period, and then PALS 2 is toddler, early preschool. And it's in Spanish and English. And the coach in the traditional model comes to the parent's home. They view each week a short video clip with very believable models demonstrating how to do these different behaviors or strategies. And the mother becomes the expert. She stops and starts the video and talks to her coach about what she thought about that interaction, what she thought worked, and what she thought she might do differently. She is building this trusting relationship with her coach, and that's a key ingredient. She's then going to practice with her child in all sorts of everyday situations what that session was about, giving rich language input while building on the child's interest. And after that occurs, she and her coach are going to look at this video together and talk about what happened. The mother self-reflects, or the father critiques what happened, what might go well if they change things a bit. So the self-reflection and critiquing is a key ingredient, we feel, to the success of this program. And then another area that we think is critical is bringing other family members in that are critical in the child's life. And we do that multiple times. They can be there every session, but we specifically invite them 3 times across each of the PALS 1 and 2 sessions so that the caregiver can teach them what he or she is learning. The coach can tell whether the mother or father is learning the activity, and the caregiver has other family members to support them. And this seems to be very effective. So this is a video. In these sessions, mothers and fathers will see different situations that give them an idea about what might happen with their own child. You're going to watch this little guy, 18 months old, learn a word right before your very eyes in this little play activity. Uh-oh. Okay, I need you guys to turn that on. Oh.
One, two, three, four. shortcut. Shortcut, that means it didn't go all the way around. It went right through the hole. Oh, did you see that? That green ball took a shortcut too.
So the coach and parent will talk about what happened in that video clip and how the parent might think that could happen with their child. This is a video. One thing we're trying to do in PALS is try to get these interactions to just be part of the fabric of the family's interactions with the child. So a lot of the videos, this particular clip, the mother's just finished giving this baby a bath in the sink, and part of those bathing clips are in the PALS session. And now she's playing and talking and bringing out a little board book. Oops.
Story. Should we look at the book? Hey, BAMS. You see the penguin and the doggy? There's the penguin, there's the doggy, doggy, doggy. Oh, that's silly. There's a rabbit, conejo. You see the fish? That's what the fish does.
Okay, next one. So, again, the parent and coach talk about what they've seen in the video. It's also built into what the parent feels they might try to do across the next week, related to these different sessions. And so PALS has been researched extensively in random assignment studies and numerous publications. And we consistently get changes in parents' behavior in these random assignment studies. And we found that the caregiving environment and PALS works equally well for these very low birth weight children as it does for full term. The same behaviors are important and they predict change in the child to the same extent. So we're seeing results where it encourages parents to use more rich language input with their children in responsive ways, more scaffolding of their learning, and in turn, and through mediation analyses, we know it's the change in the parents' behavior that predicts the growth in vocabulary with norm reference tests, complex language with the preschool language scale, and also a lot of findings in the social and self-regulation area. So now we have a new challenge. We have our traditional original home visiting model, but we're in the middle of a study to try to do this remotely. No one goes to the home. The parent gets a netbook. The sessions are on the netbook. There's a camera embedded in it that they can video themselves with their child. Their coach is far, far away, sets up a call using Zoom. They can view the video together and critique and talk about it. We've done 1 year of a 3-year Goal 3 Institute of Educational Sciences grant with this, and I'll show you how this looks. We're also bravely beginning to try to put a lot of this on a platform and come up with some creative ways to simulate the coaching experience, because this becomes so expensive and makes it very difficult to scale. And it may be that certain parents can make use of this approach, whereas others need the actual coaching approach. So in this Goal 3, we randomly assigned this first year, we have 3 years, 25 Head Start classrooms to get a classroom intervention called TEAM, the early education model, remote coach for the teacher, many, many video professional development modules about how to build language, reading, early literacy, and a business as usual. And then 184 families this first year were randomized to either get PALS or not get PALS. And you see we have a full factorial design. And we hypothesize that when children are as old as 4 from these very low-income homes, without having any really rich experiences up to this point, the important, what we expect to see is that team with PALS will predict the best outcomes, that they get consistency in their classroom environment and their home environment. So let's watch just a little bit of this coaching remotely and the mom. This is a coach. She's in her house late at night. This works for families. They like this because they can do this at 10 o'clock at night, set up their coach call. A lot of times we're watching moms in bed with their netbook and their coach is talking to them. And the coaches are willing to do this any time of the week that works for the families. So can we see this video?
So let's talk about this week, how did it go practicing labeling and all those other wonderful concepts that we've learned so far?
I got to get the hang of it because, you know, like you say, you notice a trend, I'll say this, that, and I'm starting to do names, so they helped me too, so.
Oh, good. I noticed in the videos that you were trying to catch yourself. I am so impressed. Let's go to the video since we're already getting ahead of ourselves talking about those concepts that apparently you paid very well attention. Very focused in her program. I'm going to send some stars. Let me remind myself. Send stars. Because you're doing an awesome job. The videos are uploading on time. Props to you, man. Very good job.
So I think you get a little bit of a sense of how this works. What seems to be very powerful is the coach and the parent being able to talk together through Zoom, but also see the video together and talk about it. And so with just 1 year of results, I'm really encouraged about some of our language results in English. And this is in Spanish and English, and the children is assessed in their home language. We see expressive one word, and as predicted, it's a classroom by PALS interaction, actually significant with this just a third of our cohort. And in Spanish, we get a PALS versus no PALS for expressive one word, and a preschool language expressive communication scale finding. Even though it's a trend, we get a really nice effect size. And again, it's a team by PALS. So we're really interested in looking at this question of how can you enhance the quality of the classroom or center environment that children spend so much time in, as well as the home environment. And recently we finished a study, random assignment, 3 groups in what are referred to often as family day homes. You'll see here there are more family day homes in the United States than child care centers. And these are the homes of providers, they're business people. And they have babies and toddlers and preschoolers, and hundreds of children spend their time in these centers. And these are providers that don't get much training. They're not connected to any kind of association typically. And we recruited 360, 180 Spanish and 180 English, and we developed a 20-session web-based training program, randomly assigned business as usual, a group that got the program without a mentor, and a group that got the program with a mentor, weekly mentor. And we were interested in seeing whether we could get findings without a mentor as well as with a mentor, which would mean we could then put this on our tech platform and spread it across the state at no cost to these providers. And we are so excited with this result. These are the English results. We get classroom community changes, sensitivity behaviors, shared book reading in ways that build language and oral language support. And we get it whether there was a mentor versus no mentor compared to controls. And in turn, for toddlers, and here we get to get at these children before they get to preschool. We didn't get a finding for preschool children, but we get a finding for the toddlers for language. And we get it again whether there was a mentor supporting the provider or no mentor. And so we're very excited about that particular finding. The very next year after we did that study, we put this on the tech platform and sent it out to 700 family day homes in Texas that registered to have access to it. And so in conclusion, we know this early childhood period is absolutely crucial. It's critical. And that children in poverty to get into school ready to succeed. And that a lot of children are spending large amounts of time in center-based care or family day homes that have very little oversight, very low quality. The good news, we're beginning to build across the nation some proven programs, some solutions. And now our great big challenge is how to disseminate these and get them to the people that are caring for these children. Thank you so much.
So I'm going to turn it over to you all in just a moment, but I'm going to take a little bit of license and ask the first question. In preparing for this panel today, Steve Hannon coordinated with us and identified some questions that you may want to come back to. I'm going to touch on one of them. We talked a little bit in our planning about the trade-off between efficacy and scale and how we think about in the ways that Susan was just talking about maintaining those big effect sizes as we push out interventions to folks other than us, providing them. We talked about outcome measures and whether there might be some benefit in thinking about outcome measures even at different ages that might start to unite and make a little bit more comparable different programs of research. We talked about age at start. I think you just touched on that a little bit, Susan, and whether we see differences in both the intervention nature and the outcomes for kids as we think about different ages at which we start to interact with them. But the one I want to come back to is this issue of the way it was presented in our planning was retention in these interventions, but I want to make it a little bit bigger. So last night I talked very briefly about the last mile issue, about how we get to interventions where people, as Susan just mentioned, are, right? Where they naturally find themselves and hopefully will find our intervention resources there when they spend their time there. What I think we've heard this morning is a remarkable set of last miles from the NICU in an urban environment to a village in West Africa. But I think that there are issues, and I was thinking as I was listening to y'all this morning about Ralph Smith's presentation this morning, about these issues of trust and issues of relationship with families and about how we engage families in the work that we do. And a couple of times, I think in Ralph's comments, and I think earlier, Anne, you mentioned that there's something about success, right? That I think Ralph mentioned that we should celebrate successes. And there's likely the case that as we show families the relation between what they do and what their children do, that they kind of get the point that we're trying to make. But what I'm interested in is how we think about, we as researchers, we as interventionists, we as policymakers, how we think about the differences between what we want for kids that I think is largely based on pretty robust, pretty frequently replicated and strong findings. We know, if you will, that parents should engage their kids, they should be responsive, they should be non-restrictive, they should use lots of content and interesting words, and yet we meet families where that's not common and where it may even be culturally unusual or contrary to cultural practices. So for the three of you, as you engage these very distant, if you will, from at least from my experience, distant context. How do you think about bringing parents in? How do you think about closing that gap between what you want to see parents do and what parents are sort of naturally inclined to do and maybe supported by their cultures? Thoughts?
Well, I can comment on that. In our programs, we incorporate what we call parent resource specialists. So working in the NICU, their parents, culturally diverse, Spanish-speaking, Portuguese, who've also already had a baby in the NICU, have experienced delays, have participated in early intervention. And we link them with the families now participating in research. Matter of fact, they assist in explaining the study, getting informed consent, trying to explain the importance of it, getting their viewpoint, and we've actually learned an incredible amount from the parent resource specialists through the families, because they often will not share some of the things with the physicians that they think are, the physicians may think that they won't respect them for their thoughts and for their cultural differences. But we are all getting much more sensitive to these differences and certainly recognize the importance of incorporating them into any change. So it's interesting because when I think about NICUs, we're going to have to encourage change not only among families, but of nurses and physicians who take care of these babies in the intensive care unit, if we're going to get spread through other NICUs and PICUs and hospitals in the United States.
So I think that's interesting, Betty, because there's both the connection to the families, right, these sort of implicit translators, but it also sounds like those translators, the family liaisons, are trusted informants to you, to the development team. I think that's another really, potentially really important point. What about Senegal, Ian? Or East Palo Alto?
I'm going to answer that in relation to the work we're doing with Latino families, where sometimes the differences are just as stark as in Senegal. And through a focus group recently, we found that some mothers will, once they trust the facilitator and develop that relationship, they will say, I go home and my mother-in-law says, what's the matter with you? Why do you need to take a class in parenting? That's supposed to come natural. Is something wrong? There may be tension there anyway. But instead of seeing that as a sign of curiosity and initiative and learning, it's seen as you're taking a course because you've got a problem. And then she reported kind of getting shamed for that. I mean, that could be something that could be a cause for higher attrition, that shaming business that I talked about in Senegal, but it's alive and well. And there's even a saying that I've heard from three different mothers, which is if one crab starts to crawl out of the bucket, pull the leg and to pull them out again, because you don't want to be different from people who make an effort to be different. So what do we do then? Do we not? Maybe we don't call it a parenting class. We say this is a class about children's brain development, and we'll present the information that the new science, but not draw the implications. Make sure the examples are clear enough that they themselves can draw the implications. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of being taught how to deal with the problem or a deficiency. But here's this cool new thing, like the something like the still face paradigm, which everybody looks to. I didn't know he came. And then they go home and try it, and then they show it to the husband, and so forth. Because, just like in the Kumar article, there are the mother-in-law can be a total deal-breaker. The father can be a total deal-breaker. Mm-hmm. I'm not turning this TV down, ever. It's going to be on, all night, so forget reading in a quiet corner. So how do you strengthen the mother, bring the father into it, in order to feel confident enough to not view herself as needing help or extra work or mother therapy, but becoming an expert in child development.
Susan?
Well, one of the most successful experiences I think we've had is we went into a very low, very poor neighborhood in Houston, but the neighborhood had a strength, and that was its senior citizens. And we recruited the senior citizens to be to partner with the PAL staff as coaches to the parents. They lived in that community. They wanted to see these young families who were quite isolated. They didn't have extended family. And the senior citizens formed this incredible network to support these families and learned about many resources, not only to help support the PALS program, but also to support the family to deal with crises that interfered with parenting and the uptake of PALS. And the families came together in a community center with the senior citizens regularly, just to sort of talk and eat and have fun as a community. So I found that just a very rewarding model. And it was not expensive because the senior citizens were volunteers.
That's great. We have a few more minutes, questions or comments from you. There are microphones set up. Christopher.
Hello, Christopher Price with Bright by Three, and we have been trying very hard to take all of this great research and try to scale it to a statewide level or beyond. Dr. Bonnie Camp has been instrumental to our understanding and learning in Colorado and influential as well. And I meet with her as often as I can, and she has noodled recently on this notion of incorporating music ambiently to, her idea is, and she hasn't found any research, and believe me, sounds like she's looked pretty hard, about whether the notion of sort of a repetitive pattern in music, but with a twist, so it's not entirely anticipatory. And I know with Lena and so much of what has been said already today and in similar venues has looked at ambience in terms of noise and something to discriminate away from parent and child interactions and such. And I was wondering if any of you were familiar with or had explored or had knew anybody who was, or and if not, if you have any general thoughts on whether or not, because nothing could be more scalable than if we could come up with the sort of patterns in music that could be shared ambiently. I mean, if you could imagine a Pandora station dedicated to the cause of keeping, you know, recognizing patterns for repetitive, but not entirely repetitive, to, you know, keep everybody a little off kilter, and whether or not that could be useful, especially in areas of culturally relevant home environments.
Folks? Music.
I've heard of some studies going on right now in Sweden utilizing music, but I haven't heard anything about the rhythmicity. There's certainly a lot going on with recorded, at least in a NICU, maternal heart rate, maternal voice speaking, and it's shown to have incredible physiologic effects. There's decreased apnea or cessation of breathing, a more stable heart rate, improving in the baby's activity, improving in the baby's growth. So I'm still a believer of it's the voice that is important, and I have a bias towards parent voice, either mother or father. We haven't been discussing fathers too much, but they really need to be brought into this. I think it's so critically important, and I know we've had some sessions with fathers from our NICU, and they say they feel peripheralized. When physicians and nurses come in talking about the baby, their primary eye contact is with mom. So we're all working at trying to bring fathers in and asking fathers more about how they feel. But I don't have too much. I know there was some research going on for a while with playing Mozart in the NICU, and they were unable to identify any long-term benefit from it, except perhaps they enjoy classical music as they're growing older. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have.
Other questions?
No, a question.
Here comes one.
Foundation. On this question of getting the message across, across cultural boundaries or within cultural practices, Anne, you mentioned that when you showed that show and tell session in Senegal, that the lady in red came out and said, well, this is actually good, this builds the brain and so on. And I just wondered how much the message of this builds the brain is itself culturally biased or culturally anchored. I mean, we all think of the brain as the mechanism for thinking, and we're all familiar with the research that it's plastic and so on. But does that message resonate? And if so, how does it need to be conveyed?
You mean does the scientific?
Yeah, that this is all about building the brain. I mean, I can see some cultural reactions that, what do you mean? I mean, there are certainly places in the U.S. where the reaction would be, what do you mean, building the brain?
I mean, it is so alien and strange as those customs seem to us, our science is to them. And Kumar and Darmstadt, in their paper, describe drawing on metaphors that that are accepted. Like, for example, the skin-to-skin contact is particularly hard to achieve, and it's really a wonderful thing to do. You can save a baby's life by doing that, but because the baby is polluted, and the consequences of polluting the mother are much bigger than just she's a mess for a while, they have spiritual consequences. That's a very, very hard sell. So they get metaphors from people like, well, you know, mangoes, when they're underripe, you make them warm, and then they're ripe. Or an egg, a chicken that gets off an egg, that chicken will not hatch, so keeping it warm. They didn't even have they had to make up a special word for it. They called it cold fever. There was no word for hypothermia, But they invoked metaphors that could be used as the message because they were already acceptable and already understood. Another thing was there were no preparations for the birth. And so going out and getting that untouchable woman, that would sometimes take 2 hours while the baby lay there with no cover on and often died in that interval, right? There were no preparations because that was considered taboo. But then you think the husband they would talk to the husband and say, well, when you think about planting your field, you plan way ahead. If you didn't have that ready at that time, the field would not grow, and then map onto that. And then apropos of music, part of the Indian program is making up songs, letting the families make up songs about some of these new ideas and get together and sing them. And Tostan, I mean, whoa, music is going on all the time in those villages, and they too have developed themes around these that you dance to. So it's much more inclusive and intersensory and, you know, involving many, many levels and layers and stakeholders than we can probably imagine or afford to do. But there seems to be real wisdom in it.
So I know our time is short. Charlie, you get the last question. Oh,
thank you.
You're welcome.
So, talking points here. So it seems, you know, in the discussions this morning and the background on this is that, you know, the rationale for doing this is to create the means by which children can be successful in school and later life in the U.S. in a very dynamic, knowledge-based environment, and therefore the vocabulary is so important. So doesn't it seem then that we need to look at our various cultures in terms of our citizens in the United States, the people coming here, to have some sense of what they're seeking in terms of their child's success in this world, in this framework, in this environment and context? And I'll just quit talking, but it's very much a important message for all of us here to kind of have the talking points that are going to be persuasive or most sensitive to share this information with all the diverse folks that we're serving. So, thank you.
Great point. Thank you. And with that, I want you to join me in thanking the panel.